Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection between food and grief, with your hosts, Sara Tangora
and Bobby Conforto.
On this show, we're going to really explore where grief and food intersect, how they go hand in hand, different people's experiences with their specific traumas and how food played a part from the beginning to the end of that experience.
And how as individuals, we uniquely process life's traumas and losses through either the longing for, the creating of, the avoiding of, the obsessing over, and the eating of food.
I remember right after Michael died, I still miss him, but I missed him so badly that night that I stopped at the convenience store on the corner and I bought a container of Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia. It's too sweet, you know, it's too everything. And I went home with it and I took it to bed and I thought to myself, gee, so this is my first menage a trois after Michael's death. Me, Ben, and Jerry. And I ate the entire thing.
What do you think your relationship to food was during times of crisis?
I think that my sister and I use food to reward ourselves.
I wish I had something more interesting to say, but definitely like spaghetti and meatballs and chocolate cake.
My mom still can't eat Rugola. It makes her too sad.
I've also experienced a lot of loss, as has Bobby. And I think we really wanted to find a way where we could like work together. There's something that feels very compelling about doing a project with you, Mom, as just kind of a missing piece in life and just something we've always wanted to do, but not known quite how.
Can't think of anything better myself.
I think that, I mean, any conversation about grief, I think, prepares everyone for grief because there are so few conversations about grief. It's why I think that what you guys are doing is so important.
This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit.
Good morning. It's good to be back. Oh my gosh, I missed last week. It is Thursday, January 23rd. I'm Emily Pearson, and this is the Main Course OG. Patrick, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
I'm here with my co-host, Patrick Martins, who I was on the road with last week, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but I missed being in the studio. We were doing some live action. Today, we have two really special guests in the studio with us. We have Sung Kim, one of the top private chefs and caterers in New York City, who I was reading some amazing celeb testimonials about you. I'm sure everybody thinks that, but especially Sarah Jessica Parker, George Stephanopoulos. There's some cool ones on your website. And we have Dennis Kulin, one of the greatest personalities in the food scene in New York and a longtime restaurateur. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us, guys.
Good morning.
Thanks,
Sung. You look nervous. It's not TV. It's just a microphone. Nobody can see you. They just feel your energy. And speaking of, so we're gonna, Patrick, are we cool to jump right in?
Let's jump in. Word Fantastic. Association.
So we always start off with word association. We want to keep everybody feeling good and loose. We've selected a word or term for each person, and we ask that you sort of give a quick response. So, Sung, Sarah Jessica Parker,
lovely and the sweetest mom.
The food is?
The sweetest
mom. Oh, the sweetest mom.
Her mom is amazing.
Oh, she's her so mom. Yes.
So she gave you a testimonial that you were allowed to use on your website.
Well, I never actually used her name per se.
It was just SJP.
And I think people just assumed
All right, I'm sorry. The New Yorkers definitely know who SJP is, or maybe most female fans. So
now I've heard that show is outdated now. It's actually not as progressive towards women today as 20 years ago. Is that true, or is that just some people being crazy?
What do you guys think?
People being crazy.
Yeah. My thing is more like the quality of the filming is outdated. If you look at like the early episodes, it's like it's grainy. Like you can't watch it on an HD TV.
And then sometimes you see the film like catch flame and like cut up and fades to white. But I will say, yes, I can put myself in the right moment in time. Like if I read something from the 17th century, I'm not like, what a racist. No, you try to see, you know, what things might have been like back then, and maybe they're cool for the time. Just times are different.
The most outdated thing is like her Apple computer.
You get mad at people getting sick pre-penicillin. No, you can't get mad at them. They died. So what? Who cares?
Patrick likes to call himself Joy Behar. I don't know if he pitched you on this show saying, you know, we'd like to call it our version of The View. We do a round table, fast pace. Dennis, your word association, Lower East Side.
Loisada.
Loisada. Dirty, gritty, fun.
Still?
No. It used to be dirty, gritty, fun. Now it's getting gentrified, as everything else does. It's like one of the last strongholds, and it's quickly fading.
But you still live there, right?
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Why is it dirty? Do they not clean the streets? Do people just leave garbage out there? Are you talking about dog poop? What's going on?
It used to be dirty, gritty, fun. Mm-hmm. Now it's just... It's still dirty because.
So the toilet seats that you people did lines of cocaine on are cleaner now than they used to
be?
Yes. Okay.
All right, Patrick, your word is speeches.
Well, I was asked to read a speech at the Good Food Awards, which was a meeting of like 500 of the country's most interesting artisans divided into all these categories like chocolate and spirits and elixirs and charcuterie and cheese and beer and all that. So it was cool. I basically read for the charcuterie people.
Are you good at speeches?
Not really. You know, it's funny. I've given a couple of great speeches, but I average probably a B-, which is disappointing to me because in person, obviously, God, if everyone could see, people are mouth open at my charisma. I'm, you know, just rolling out words. And yet when it's a speech and you have to write it, so I've over the years tried to go improv. That doesn't really work. Then I try to just do bullet points and semi-improv. Reading a speech doesn't work because I don't look up enough. So, yeah, I've never really found my path. You know?
Michael Pollan spoke at the Good Food Awards.
He was actually very serious.
He read from his... He was not very off the cuff, and he did not look up. I didn't think that much. I don't know if that comes from being a print journalist more than anything else, but his speech was more like pre-written and read off the page.
Yeah, Alice doesn't love making speeches. It's funny, whereas Carlo, you know, little kids who don't even speak Italian are like, I understood everything and I love them. I mean, it's amazing. A great speech person. They don't exist. I think my mom grew up in a time where like everybody was making speeches. Martin Luther King, all these people.
And you set the bar really high there. No, Martin Luther King.
There were these people with manifestos. And now who's a great speaker? I guess Bill Clinton, but I don't even know, you know. I can't name you.
I don't know.
Great
Who
speakers.
Are the best orators in this moment?
Crickets.
Crickets.
All right.
Okay, your word is Chez Panisse, the founding of the organic movement.
That's not where I was going to go with that. Mine was more like Alice Waters inviting you into her... Just like it's warmth and hospitality and
her lair.
Yeah, it's just. I mean, I've been very fortunate that every time we've been to Chez Panisse, I think Alice has always been there since you've known her for so many years, and she makes a point to be there when we come in. So I'm very spoiled, mm-hmm. but I get always a little starstruck around her, and it's just everyone assumes I think that her food is going to be very like foo-foo, and there's something really just. There's a layer of simplicity to it.
She has a three-part menu, app, main, dessert, and she saw all these meat people there, like bagels. She was like, get around to pizzas, you know? She's like, fire up the pizza oven, and she was like giving us all these extra pizzas because she was like, these people
We had a pretty legendary dinner. We brought all of our you know, customers, for lack of a better term, but artisan colleagues who won in the charcuterie category at the Good Food Awards. So we had Cesare Casella, who's a chef and prosciutto maker from New York, Sam Edwards from Virginia, and Lorenza Passetti from Volpe Foods in St. Louis. And it was a pretty powerhouse table. And then Alice Waters, of course, you know. And we had our friend Tony from Tempesta. So it was fun. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Chez Panisse's, I highly recommend for anyone who's never been.
Amazing.
So we call this next section our roundtable panel, weekly based. I don't know. We always change what we call it. But basically, we have seven questions, topics to cover in the next 25 minutes. Patrick, I'm going to let you take it away.
Dennis, in your early restaurant ventures, you had your own unique currency that broke from relying on the almighty dollar as the principal tool for exchange. What does everyone think you two, Dennis, about alternative currencies, Bitcoin, barter, etc., alias bucks?
I did.
Oh. You don't remember? That's why your bottom line didn't work out in the end.
Yes, we gave alias dollars for every amount of money you spent. You got some dollars going.
So is that like a punch card system with loyalty?
Yeah, pretty much.
So do you barter? I mean, the Lower East Side, when a neighborhood is not gentrified and it's kind of like old school, there's a lot of giving, by get, then exchange, it was, trade.
It was a little gentrified by then because alias dollars came out 10 years after 71 opened. 71 was started everything.
So tell us, what does that mean? 71 Clinton, 71 Jason
Clinton, fresh
Maroney?
Food, no, Wiley Dufresne.
So tell us about that. What made that place so unique?
I just think it was an anomaly because it happened. We were looking at spaces on the Lower East Side. My business partner at the time lived right around the corner. She just happens to live in the building with Wiley Dufresne, Dewey Dufresne, who happened to be Wiley's father. And we were like, oh, we just found this space. Lucienne was looking at the space too, and we actually wound up getting it for $2,800 a month in rent in 1999. And you know, he's like, oh, I have a son and he works for John George and maybe he'd be interested, and one thing led to another, and that's when 71 began.
Wow. And it became historic in that what molecular cuisine got its start there before WD-50?
Before he did all that gastronomic stuff, it was just, you know, molecular. Also, it was like, you know, it was one of the first chefs that left John George and opened up his own space. He was young. Mm-hmm. He had just come from Vegas working in his place Prime, John George's place Prime. So, you know, it's just kind of like, oh, why is this place in the middle of the Lower East Side? Limousines pulling up. Meanwhile, there are heroin deals going on next door. And like, and it was just kind of like, wow, this is kind of interesting. So
cool. So, Sung, you're in catering. Don't worry, we're not asking you to barter for catering services. We're just asking what your opinion is on it. Barter, you know, different types of exchange.
I don't really believe that it exists in at least in the business model that we've created, actually, because I really do believe in paying for everything, you know, appropriately and pay everybody. And in a way, that's actually one of the best things about being in the catering model is that we're not really asking any for a favor and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, like we have those requests all the time. Like, I'm an influencer. I'm having a party for 50 people with my other influence friends. And can you do this, you know, something? And usually we say no.
That's actually really cool. It's much cooler to do business and be proper and pay and do the right thing.
No, I think so. Absolutely. And people respect that. And then they often want to do something for you out of courtesy or, you know, free or discounted because you've done the right thing. And you want to pay for services that are being given to you. But I think that's absolutely right.
When barter exists, it can be beautiful. But I've also done barter with a coffee company that shall not be named, and I was like, this is like a cup of coffee you gave me. An eighth of a cow. What the fuck?
I mean, it is nice though when you are in an industry or you create a product or a service and that you can do an exchange. I think that is something that not everybody has the luxury of doing. But when you have something that people want to trade for, you know, why not?
You could trade a service, accounting. For instance, CPA, just kidding.
All right. So we touched upon this before, but let's talk about investing in neighborhoods that could be considered bad. So, you know, Dennis, we were talking about the Lower East Side. When you went there in the 90s, there were heroin deals on the corner. You know, we're in Bushwick. Hello. Roberta's was, you know.
Exactly the same, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, for, you know, maybe
people
not
who don't live in New York City and be like, oh, that's terrible. I'm scared in that neighborhood, even though we wouldn't be. You know, we hear bad things about it.
Yeah,
but so it has these great restaurants in it.
Did you only go there because it was cheap, or did you sort of see something that might
be? No, I saw something. I mean, when I moved to New York, I moved into Chelsea, and that was in the 80s, and it was like, you wouldn't go on 8th Avenue. It was like tranny hookers and like scary. And then I was like, oh, so if this was bad, and then the next thing is like, oh, Lower East Side, that's really bad. Like, how bad could it be? You know, it's just opening the restaurant at the time, which was kind of a, you know, two-star restaurant, there was nothing around there like that. So you have like limousines pulling up, and we were like, okay, we need to open another restaurant to house the people that want to come to this one so we can have drinks. So then we opened AKA Cafe.
Yeah, no, and I think it's very similar to what Roberta's has experienced here. Like the number of black cars that would pull up, or, you know, there's the tourists who are not comfortable on the subway, but then you have locals who are. If you had to pick another neighborhood to do something in next, now, where
Coney Island.
Where would it be? And would you take the risk on a bad neighborhood?
Well,
or would you go somewhere that you know is going to
I wouldn't open a restaurant, period, in this climate right now.
By the way, Emily made quotes
I forgot we're not on TV.
Yeah, it's important to say this is what people consider bad and that it has cheap rents. We love neighborhoods like that. That's where real excitement comes from. And it is really obnoxious. I heard Spike Lee say this, that when white people move in, oh, finally, this neighborhood has arrived.
Right.
They've been making great breads and coffee houses and restaurants for decades. Yeah. You know, it's just white people don't consider it white, so it's considered bad. I mean, that really pisses me off. This neighborhood's been cool for many years, you know. It's not because Roberta's is here that all of a sudden white people live here, fewer black people, and now it's good.
Yeah.
So anyway, to clarify, there were air quotes around my dad.
Chinatown would be, I mean, it's something I think that's kind of more, it kind of reminds me of how the Lower East Side used to be, even though it kind of melds in between.
But I think, and it's gritty, and it seems and from what I'm reading that people are definitely opening there, and that seems to be the new wave.
Yes.
But you wouldn't open something now?
No.
But you're too successful. He's one of the most successful caterers in this room right now. Why would he need to go through the trials and
I don't know. Some people like having a place to be found, like a storefront, a place for someone to come in.
No, that's the one thing that I, you know, after working in the business for, you know, so long and having three restaurants, it's just like, it's nice to not have to be somewhere at 4 o'clock. So you're, you know, with these people and then, you know, just working 12 to 16 hours a day. It's just, you know, now I'm like, I work in catering. Do I feel like working today? No. I can have someone else work for me, and I can go away.
Dennis's signature line as a radio was, do you feel like you're being treated unfairly?
What is your signature line, by the way?
My signature line.
In a restaurant?
Bring it.
Bring it.
Nice.
Isn't your email even affiliated with that tagline?
Yes.
Do tell.
Oh, bring it.
You heard it here. Oh, bring it.
And Bring It Style, which is now catering.
What's it called?
Staffing companies, Bring It Style.
Bring It Style.
Good.
You know, that's a good tagline. You can add a lot of things to the end of it. I think you're going to have about 10 businesses in the next 5 years. You just add a different keyword to the end.
Exactly.
I love that. So speaking of catering, what do you guys think about the future of catering? Do you see it going completely democratic, meaning that anyone in any part of New York could sign up maybe to a local chef or caterer who prepares food on demand delivered to their door? This idea was born out of the fact that Dennis is my husband. That Patrick.
Well, we spend more time together probably because we work together 8 hours a day.
Patrick thinks that fast forward, I don't know, maybe 5-10 years, is every apartment building going to have an in-house private chef or caterer?
I think they're going to have five. My big house, I think, big building is going to have 10 chefs. And you move in and you have 10 menus given to you. And you're like, I'm going to sign up to the guy that specializes in Middle Eastern. Because where are all the chefs going to go when they're in their 60s and 70s? They're still going to want to cook. That's their art. But they don't want to work at a restaurant. So I think they might just cook in their house.
Hudson Valley.
Everybody retires north.
So catering must cost a lot. And yet, you know, is it ever going to get to the day where you can get anything catered anytime, anywhere?
I think in terms of the questions you ask, I think that model already exists, which is the restaurant. That's the restaurant industry. But in terms of catering, and also, you know, they have in a lot of other companies or startups that attempted to bring chefs into people's
like
homes.
Like kitchen surfing.
Exactly, which I was part of.
I saw. I was reading about you a little bit, but that closed.
Came from kitchen serving, indeed. Yeah, from SJP. But for some reason, those don't always work out. And I think it always ends up going back to the traditional model of the food industry, restaurants and whatnot, which is also very difficult to, make an income out of. And I do believe that there is much more potential for the private dining, where the chefs or the team will go into people's homes, whether or not they, you know, a lot of our clientele are, you know, to be honest, you know, they're very wealthy people. But it doesn't have to be just for that. And I think plenty of people want to bring a team in for special occasions or, you know, intimate parties that doesn't have to cost arm and a leg, or having to do it at a restaurant where there's a limitation of time, or maybe
freedom.
Less comfortable. Exactly.
Freedom.
Also, it's less of an expense if you're actually having people come in, because you're not paying. You're getting the wine. You're getting this. You're getting that. So at the end of the day, they're probably, if you have 20 people, mm-hmm. you have them at your home instead of at a restaurant, you're probably spending less.
So can we ask, okay, let's say Emily is turning 31, which is a big day, or 32, and she
next
decides to organize a party for 15 people in her home, you know, with the beautiful appetizer salad, you know, a cheese plate, charcuterie board from Heritage Foods, of course, which maybe you'll get a discount on. Then, you know, steak and a fun dessert. You know, plenty of wine, maybe a cocktail. What would she pay per head on that? I mean, just to give our listeners an idea.
That's really hard to say, though, because everybody wants something different. And, you know, what we do
Why describe the menus? Steak, charcuterie, cheese.
The answer is caviar. He went only high-end. He just left out the caviar.
The black caviar, not the orange kind.
Right.
So how much? I mean, does someone think $100 a head? $200. I mean, what's the ballpark today? I don't use caterers, so I'm fascinated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, smaller the number of the people we're catering towards, obviously it will be high per price head. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, going back to, you know, paying people appropriately and for their time and their talent and labor. And, you know, they all come from a restaurant industry, well, not everybody, but a lot of people that we hire, whether in the front or the back of the house, and they have gained that experience. And I really do believe that they need to be paid fairly.
No, we want you to mention the high price.
$20,000.
The contract.
I don't know.
And then Dennis, tell us, what is it? 150? I mean, a restaurant, it's 120, 100 a head, easy. If you're doing something nice, it's
plus
easily.
Like plus tax,
so 150 a head. So catering must be 200 a head.
It's something similar like that, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good. That's great.
And then do both of you have commissary kitchens, or is often your...
Yeah.
Okay. So everything is prepared off-site, and then you... come into
yeah, about 70 to 80%, and then we will finish it on site. Or I mean, oftentimes we're going to a private home, mm-hmm. and they have their kitchen. So
a very nice one, by the way.
But is there ever a rule like you're not allowed to get my kitchen dirty?
Yeah,
we want you to come ready.
No. We absolutely have to. We must leave the place better than we found it. Yeah. I mean, that's at least our rule. I don't know about other caterer chefs.
You just leave like a toaster oven that they didn't have there before. They're like, this is for you.
And then I happen to love leftovers. Not everybody does. Oh, yeah. When you like cater in somebody's home, do you leave everything, all the leftovers behind, and like it's all boxed up and in their fridge? Or are people just like, nope. Take it all away, and there's a lot of waste and spoilage.
I mean, really, anyways, first of all, the staff would either eat them, mm-hmm. you know, for their staff meal, or they would take them, or, you know, in case the client doesn't want that. But then, you know, oftentimes we usually end up leaving something behind, and that's how they remember us to call back.
That's true.
No, you always got to leave something for the team, you know? Like when they kept the Peking duck at the Peking duck house, there's always all the meat on the duck left. And I'm like, oh, whatever, you know, I have enough for 4 pancakes, so it's good enough. Now, how does a caterer's deal with inventory? What do you actually own?
Well, equipment, but all, I mean, this is New York City, so we rent everything.
So even dishes, you don't have your pitchers that are yours?
Absolutely, especially dishes and glasses and all that. They're
just
all
not
rented.
Worth owning. Okay.
No.
Party transportation. Rental.
And you can exactly. send them back dirty.
Exactly.
Oh, yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you just like reload the and broke it.
Sometimes.
Uh oh. Yeah, you just like reload the bin that they came in, yep. and then you don't have to do the dishes.
So when exactly. you're getting dishes delivered for a huge event, are you terrified that they're not going to show up? I mean, when you're relying on a delivery in a truck through the streets of New York?
It's happened, actually. I mean, yeah, just most recently in December. Yeah. I'm not going to say a name. A major rental company.
No one's listening. It's okay. Say names.
They had an issue with their system. And they almost didn't show up. So, I mean, we had to really... You know, I mean, but luckily we got ours, but I was told that there are hundreds of other customers who didn't get theirs. So,
well, being a caterer is, you know, depending on how you're hired, I think is if you're just the only thing for that event, you're also the event planner. Obviously, I'm sure you work with lots of people where there's also an event planner who might have brought you in and they're doing logistics. But if they're not, you must have a run of show like checklist that's very stressful.
I imagine Dennis being like, there's no food, there's no plates, there's no dishes, and he just starts tap dancing. Modern dance, tap dance.
He's amazing at that.
So what does January mean for your business?
You know, it's not as dead as you think it is. It's February that's usually the quietest.
Very good point. Same with our business.
Yeah, like January, people are still having parties. They're still like late parties because they want to, you know, they didn't have a Christmas party or whatever. And it's
they can still
cheaper
be
to
fat.
Do it in January.
They can still
and
eat.
People still want to like go out and party and be invited to something.
So what happens in February?
February, I go on vacation.
That's why it's the shortest month, because it has the least business. Then I mean, March, you're excited
the thing in the, again. Especially in the restaurant business, it is dead until Valentine's Day, and then it's like the dead that weekend because everyone spent all their money, and then it starts to pick up again.
Well, that's why Restaurant Week became Restaurant 3 Weeks.
Exactly.
It's like it started this week, and it goes until February 9th this year.
Right.
So it's filling that void, and then I know that the restaurant industry hates when Valentine's Day falls on a Friday or Saturday night.
Because they would have done good business anyway.
Exactly.
Correct.
Exactly.
They would have done good business anyway, and all they want is it for it to be on a Monday or a Tuesday.
Right.
Because
when it's dead. Exactly.
It's just extra.
Well, they never have to worry about Thanksgiving. That'll always follow on a Thursday.
That is true.
So, for us, it means big discounts. And, you build up the inventory for us not to run out of anything in December when everyone's buying. So you have a huge inventory on December 31st. So we discount everything by 20-30%.
Right.
And that clears it all out. So by February 1st, our freezers are empty. You can walk through them and all that. But it's also a time to, look ahead at everything.
Well, so I was going to ask, what month would you say is when you get the most inquiries and planning for the rest of the year? Like, so for Patrick and I, this is the time we sit down and we really think about, you know, at least through August, September, our mind is like planning, you know, what's coming, you know, what are we bringing in specialty animals, working with new farmers? Are we doing events? Are we traveling? Is like, when do people wake up and be like,
I need a catering gig?
Yeah.
Usually a month or two before events. I mean, it's just really throughout the year.
Yeah.
Unless it's a wedding or something.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. For sure. Yeah, at least a year or minimum 6 months in advance. Small weddings.
So how many, for a very high-end caterer like you, very talented, how many gigs do you need a year? I mean, a month, let's say,
to
be successful? You know, I mean, what do you judge it? By how much you make on one event or how often you're working?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. Like in the summertime, what, like 2, 3, 4 events? I mean, really. Yeah.
A month?
A week. Yeah. But I mean, even 4, it will be really pushing it. And there are times during the holiday season or even, you know, during the Hamptons time that, you know, we could potentially have 2 events in a day, which we don't prefer because I personally would not want to be. I wouldn't accept a job unless I'm there personally with my team. Usually the 3 would be an ideal number because it's not just the day of the event or the cooking. It's really just everything else that happens, like you said, that if we're not working with an event planner, that we have to do everything ourselves. So,
what's your guys' management style where you're basically running a MASH unit? I mean, essentially is what catering is. So what's your management style? How do you get temporary workers to do what you need? And how many of your workers are temporary, all that?
I mean, pretty much all of my people are temporary. I mop a lot of people from great performances because they're very well trained. And I pay them more.
That's $10.99.
Right? So, I can have, up to 15 to 20 people just kind of, you know, and then I have like maybe a roster of 30 people that I can call.
So you're always dealing with your core team, even though.
I have my A list, my B list, and then the C when it's just like,
uh-oh.
What about on the culinary side? I have to imagine that that's.
Yeah, it would be the same. Yeah.
But isn't that a little more stressful to not have the A team? I mean, I know front of house is just as important as far as how is everything is presented. But at the end of the day, when you really need a core group of people preparing with you and doing things in advance.
Maybe just how I have to hustle a little more.
All right, all right. You guys are very, you know what, I think catering people are very good at rolling with the punches.
You don't know what to expect. So what's your management style? Like, hey, everybody, this is going to be fun. Or like, don't fuck up. This is serious.
Both.
Are you a mean general, an easygoing general?
I'm extremely nice.
You are?
Yes.
All right, worst
catering.
For those
of you who couldn't see on radio, there was a side eye given.
Worst catering offsite gig of all time. Tell us your horror story.
I went into a gig, not with Sung, but another chef, and we went in, and we were there like maybe 2 hours before, which is usually when it's good enough time to set up, and they were putting the kitchen in. And I was like, excuse me. I'm like, we need to use the stove. And they're like, oh, well, you can use the top of it, but the gas hasn't been turned on yet. And
like, so like, what's the top of it?
I was like, exactly, like the stove top. I'm like, am I supposed to put that on top and hopefully something will cook? I was like, no, 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 you have to turn it on. And they're like, well, it's going to be illegal. I don't give a...
You can curse.
I don't give a fuck. Turn that fucking thing on. I couldn't get into the refrigerator because it had no handle. So you had to like pull. It was just like, oh my God. And then everybody showed up. And then they were so cheap, they wanted the glasses like away at the certain time. So they're picking up the glasses. People have glasses in their hand. They're like, you know, party rentals here. I had to take glasses out of people's hands. They had no plastic cups. I was like, drink that right now. Just like,
oh my God.
Gig is over. I'm like, I've had it with this place. So
that's hard too when the client has a request and then yes. It makes it appear like it's your doing.
My fault. And then like, I have to be nice to people when all I want to do is strangle them.
Mm-hmm. Song, how about you?
Same thing. I mean, you know, an event planner rented a space that is a private residence, and they were making it sound like it was actual like an event space, but the guy was actually living there, and he came back and forth and eating our food. But in the middle of all this, right before the first course started, the stove stopped working, which was electric, and nothing was basically done about that. He wasn't there, and yeah. I think that's why it happened.
I would have fixed it.
I cooked a medieval feast for my graduate school master's course, and I had like 15 courses that I was doing all by myself, and my professor was coming with her husband, a famous artist, and my four or five favorite friends from the class, and I was basically sinking. And I remember my mother got Mark Vetri, who was the chef of Bella Blue at the time, to come over. And he came over for a half hour and literally did little things to each dish and saved it. And it was a fantastic meal. The worst place I've ever been to, I hate to put anything bad about Alice Waters, who's a dear friend, but she had an event at the Italian Consulate.
Last year.
And it was a walk-around grazing event. And they had huge hot bowls of soup.
Everybody was given a full bowl of soup, which was delicious. Yeah. But the room was overcrowded because she has so many friends and people near and dear to her. And it was not like in a little teacup. You still needed a spoon. And so you had to find somewhere to perch yourself.
But there was no place to perch. So now every time I see her, I'm like, I have a great investment idea for you, Alice. Hot soup for campers or mountain climbers. It's a mountain climber thing or marathon runners. It's a little pack and it's super scalding soup. She's like, shut.
Mine was, it wasn't so much a horror story, but I will never forget it. Before I was at Heritage, I worked for Cesare Casella, who's a chef and salumi maker, and he was invited to go cook at the James Beard pop-up restaurant at the Milan Expo that was happening. And they did a rotating group of chefs, and every chef came in for 3 or 4 nights, and you were supposed to send sending your list in advance and expecting the things that you, even like gelatin, you know, was not something that they would find readily. And the kitchen had no like screens to block the sun. So it was the middle of July. It was maybe like 105 degrees in the kitchen. Cesare cooked in a bathing suit because it was so hot because everyone was just sweating. You're in front of the stove, the sunlight's pouring in. I was told I'd have no culinary background. I'm just a good eater. And I was told I could come if I was his sous chef. So I had to learn all the recipes in advance. And he told me that I could only come if I took charge of dessert.
Did you wear a one piece or a two piece?
One piece, exactly. So I was in charge of dessert, and we were doing a panna cotta, and we needed to do a quick time in the blast chiller, and I forgot about it. Oh, God. And actually, it ended up being great because everyone was so hot that all they wanted after this like heavy meal in the middle of July was something frozen. So awesome. A shitty situation turned into a good one.
Was he still wearing his rosemary?
Yes. Always the rosemary and the chef jacket. He just, no one could tell behind his apron that he had shorts on, basically, a bathing suit.
So, all right, well, let's ask this question, talking about being bad. Are people in the food industry as naughty today as they used to be in the 80s and 90s?
Ask Mario Batali.
No. That would be no, then.
Naughty as, what do you mean?
I don't know, drugs.
I think this conversation stemmed from, like, there was a time in the 90s where
everybody
there was intense,
like,
drug use, yes, and then it was alcohol, right, more so. And now, where are we at?
I don't think so. It's nothing like it used to be. I mean, everybody used to do drugs.
Why is that?
Or is it more private?
That's why Nouvelle Cuisine came out, because everybody was doing coke in the bathroom, so they could only eat a little small thing. They just made it look really glamorous, but it was just like...
They didn't have an appetite.
A fucking chicken leg. What the hell is that?
That is great. That's a tag. Nouvelle Cuisine because of coke use.
Oh, totally. That was totally... You know, in the 80s.
Maybe that was when the 20-course tasting.
Exactly.
Single
things came out.
Not just they smoke a lot of weed.
Yeah, right. Weed.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think these days it's more edibles and weed rather than...
That alcohol. And
why
is
that? Is it, I guess, information didn't... There was no internet back then, so people were just local partying. Now they're like, oh, I could get sick if I do that. I don't know. It's just interesting that stopped.
Well, I think it's because...
Or slowed down.
Drugs are expensive.
And pot is becoming legal.
That's true. Well, we have Alan Pearson here. You don't have to answer. You could just nod, but... Emily's father. I seem to recall going out with my mom a lot in the 70s, and maybe it was just because I was young, but I always imagine her staying out much later. Like, they would go post-theater at 11 and come home at 1:30. Like, that was just totally normal, even when I would go out with her. Did people do stuff later back then?
Well, it depends on the where in the country that all emanated from. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about New York, yes, people did stay out much later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had Studio 54. You had a lot of other venues where you could go, you could have dinner, and then you could go and drink and party.
Were the kids in tow?
No, the kids were not in tow.
There was Studio 45 with a babysitter with 900 kids. But I will say, I was watching one of these documentaries on PBS, you know, what's that guy who does all the documentaries? And it was about New York and the wealthy robber barons. And I think there were these Vanderbilt parties where you had to get invited to. And I think they started at midnight. They started at midnight. It was so weird to me.
Was Dennis there?
Dennis. Sounds like fun.
So we're going to take a very quick break. We will be right back. We just have to take a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit, a go-to shop for anyone interested in natural wines and boutique spirits. There's a large selection of everything from orange wines, pet nats, and reds from around the world. Whether visiting the shop in person or online, looking for a gift for a loved one, or that everyday dependable bottle, you're sure to find lots of interesting wines at Henry's. There's free shipping on orders over $300 on the website henrys.nyc, and case discounts when you visit the store located in Bushwick. Cheers.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are in studio with Dennis Kulin.
Bring it.
And Sung Kim. We've been talking about catering and New York sort of then and now. Looks like maybe a tequila shot's about to happen. Always a good Thursday morning here in the studio. So, how do you guys really get the word out? Finish your shop first, of course. How do you get the word out for new business in the catering industry? You guys are caterers to the stars, caterers to the high end, caterers to anyone who wants to hire you.
To the Hamptons.
Yes, catering to anyone who wants to hire you to have great, delicious food at their home.
Word of mouth.
Yeah, it's just definitely word of mouth. I mean, you know, you have a website and stuff to promote you, but, you know, it's just really, it's word of mouth.
Is social media an extension of that word
Instagram,
of mouth?
Instagram, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say. I mean, she's on Facebook. I hate Facebook, but...
Did you hear Facebook? Did you read Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are combining into one mega company called YouTwitface? Did you hear that?
No.
That's in the news today. I think it was Eater.
For real?
I thought you were going to say it was the New York Post telling false headlines again.
Oh, yeah. They said fairway close. Fairway close. And the owners were like, we're not closing. Emily and I were listening on 10-10 Wins. We're like, that can't be good for business.
There was a, I got a text message from a group of friends. My parents live on the Upper West Side and are regulars at Fairway. And I got a text message last night. My dad doesn't know this yet. And there was a man on the street interview in some publication asking quoting a man named Alan, age 78, which is a little bit older than him, about his, if he was going to be upset about Fairway closing. He's like, well, I do go there every week for my chicken salad. It's not quite as good as the chicken salad I get upstate at ShopRite. But, you know, it's a good mayo ratio. And all my friends were like, please tell me this is Alan Pearson. Oh, they were like, this Upper West Side, right decade of age, right name. They were now like, it's got to be.
If he had said white fish salad, that would have been your father.
Yeah.
Nah, not so much.
No. More of a tuna fish guy over there. So
there's no chunks in white fish salad. So
I was
like
in Zabar's
pudding.
Yes.
It's like eating cream of wheat.
Ugh. So... sometimes, but I was in Zabar's yesterday killing some time after I parted ways with you, and theirs is chunky.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you do anything, by the way, from catering? Like, I'm like, I want arugula, and not the big kind, the little kind, and, you know, I want bagels, or I want Peking duck. You're like, you got it. Or do you provide a set group of menus that the person has to choose from?
It's a combination of both.
Okay.
Yeah, but, I mean, everything is customized to a degree.
And I would love to have you come do a theme dinner.
Sure.
You know, I would love, you know, where anytime. We decorate
watch out.
The
okay.
house.
Wait, watch out. Costume. Don't say anytime. Yes. His themes, you may be cooking medieval.
We did a theme at Grape and Grain once, and it was an Asian theme. So my friend and I got dressed as...
In drag.
Kimchi
and soju.
It was kimchi and soju, and we got dressed in... Newspapers that we made out of a traditional Korean dress.
Mm. Wow. That's and the cool. food?
And we,
or the food didn't matter.
Did
it was more about the dress.
Sung did the food, and we were the waitresses.
So cool.
Nice. Are you a chef?
They weren't drunk at all, by the way.
Oh, I see. Well, by the way, I love medieval food because if it tastes like shit, you're just like, they had different palates back then.
Exactly. For me, the only thing, I think of like the, I don't know, the enormous like, turkey leg
yes.
at Disney World
yeah.
and I don't know. Have you ever been to medieval times?
No, like what else did they serve besides a turkey leg? I don't
they served
know.
Everything. They had fruits and vegetables. There was agriculture back then. We're not talking about Sumeria.
I think it was very meat heavy. All right.
Pre-1980, Dennis is like, what? How did they live? How did they sustain themselves?
Well, speaking of, you said you moved to New York in the 80s. Where did you move from?
Long Island.
Oh.
Rockville Center, not far.
New York through and through.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I get my car fixed.
That's
Mercedes
right.
Mercedes has a dealership there.
There's a lot of dealerships there.
All right, so what's next for both of you? Obviously, Dennis, you said you're never opening a restaurant. You are very happy in catering world.
Yes, so I'm just going to continue with my staffing company and continue just doing catering. I love
and
it.
How do people contact you if they want an outrageous feast? What do they call?
They call Sung.
Sung.
True story.
Okay.
And are you guys always a package deal?
No, not necessarily. I have my own gigs. She has her own gigs. And we just kind of...
But you're more successful when you're together.
I think so. I think we both get each other. And, you know, we work probably about 70 or 80% of the time together.
He's okay. My gay husband.
Yes. He's your gay husband. Yes. Gay Dennis.
Everybody needs one.
Everyone needs a gay Dennis.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, never mind.
So, Sung, what's interesting? What's an interesting, a challenging gig that you have coming up or just did? Something like very difficult because the person was vegan or you're having to deal with gluten free?
I mean, those are always now, you know, but.
That's already.
But I mean, you know, I think the challenge is just continue to, you know, maintain our standard or, you know, actually exceeding our standards. And just keep on going because, I mean, we, you know, people think that catering is easy or, mm-hmm. you know, I don't even know how to, you know, compared to the restaurant. But I really think it's much more mm-hmm. difficult, I mean, challenging. So, I mean, we kept just, just building our, you know, standard and just keep on working at it and exceeding every single time.
So as someone who's about to call a caterer, a listener out there, what are two or three bits of advice that you would give them to be a good customer or to get the most out of the caterer or to benefit from your talents the most?
Well, quite honestly, I think they should talk to more than one caterer, you know, because everybody has different budget and maybe a different, you know, expectations. So, you know, they should be able to compare and go with it. And, you know, I never really imagined that I'm the only person that they're talking to. Mm-hmm. You know, and also that give us a little bit of freedom, you know, in a way, you know, if they are just like choosing a restaurant, that they are choosing us and for what we offer based on what they know about us, then they should, you know, trust us.
Food or service or number of waiters needed, whatever.
Right, both. Yeah, and yeah. I think that's why the word of mouth thing comes in very, you know, it is important that, you know, they usually get recommended from a friend, or maybe they have attended one of the events that we have catered. Mm-hmm. So that's how it usually happens. So there is a bit of a, you know, understanding or expectation of how we're going to deliver.
That's got to be a two-way street too, right? Like there's obviously people that maybe have certain expectations, and do you ever have to say, you know, I don't think that maybe we're the right fit for what you're looking for?
You're asking for too much cheese, Emily.
Yes, too much cheese. I don't want you to cook it all. Just prepare the cheese for me.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is two-way street. Yeah, so that's bad.
What did you cook for Bill Murray, if we're allowed to ask? Is that impolite to ask someone to reveal?
It was appetizers, actually.
Yeah, it was a paso d'oeuvres for an opening. Yeah, for an opening. Actually, it was a book launch party for a director and his wife that he had worked in the past.
Hmm. So to round out the show, we have a very important question. We are very big fans of the Royals, or the former Royals, Megxit.
I can't wait to go to Canada.
Yeah, Canada just became cool.
So if you were invited to Canada to do a catered lunch for Harry and Meghan and Archie.
That says welcome, mental health. Happiness, peace.
No paparazzi. What would you serve?
Fried chicken.
Yeah?
Korean fried chicken.
Well, they'll... Oh.
Interesting. Right. Well, that was a firm answer.
Yeah. And you, were both on board with the same thing. All right. Clearly, someone has called you to inquire about catering for Megxit.
All right. Well, this has been a very, very good show.
Thank you guys for joining us. You're invited back anytime.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having us.
We have Food by Sung and...
Bring It Style.
Bring It Style. You heard it here. We will be back with you guys next week, and stick around for the next show. I believe it's Taste of the Past. Yep. All right. Thanks, Scott. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.